Welcome to The Kingstonian, a podcast that profiles individuals who are passionate about what they do for a living, about what organization they belong to, or simply passionate about the community they are a part of. Hello there, and welcome. My name is Dave Cunningham. John Gerritsen spent 35 years in politics, 16 on Kingston City Council and 19 in the Ontario Legislature. He also tested positive for the coronavirus in March of last year. In this episode of the Kingstonian podcast, I speak with John about the cruise that led to that positive test while he was in quarantine at CFB Trenton. I also took advantage of his political experience to discuss the challenges our elected leaders face when trying to deal with the impact of this pandemic. John, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, Dave.
I should say welcome back because
you have a lot of good memories.
You were on the program once before with your son, Mark, in October of 2016.
Okay, I remember it well.
I invited you back here to talk about the coronavirus and also the challenges that political leaders have in dealing with a pandemic like this. And in particular, you, because you have personal associations with both the virus and being in politics. So thank you very much for agreeing to sit down and chat.
It's good to be here.
Let's start with the fun stuff. So let's go back to the winter of 2020, and you and your wife, Asunta, are taking a cruise. And where was the cruise going?
The cruise was going from San Francisco to Hawaii and back again. My wife and I are avid bridge players, and it happened to be a bridge cruise, which basically means that you play bridge with other people on sea days and on days when the ship is docked somewhere. You know, you take your day trips on the various islands. We'd never been to Hawaii, so the two things sort of blended together perfectly, and we booked the cruise probably sometime in the middle of December, about 2 months before we left.
How long was the cruise?
The cruise was 17 days, from February the 20th to about March the 5th.
So it would be from San Francisco to Hawaii and back.
That's correct.
Had a good time?
We had a great time. We met some fantastic people, played a lot of good bridge, sat at a table with other people from Alberta who we got along with very well, and we had a great time. And that abruptly ended on the Thursday before we were supposed to dock on the Sunday, I believe it was, on the Saturday. So it was only 2 days before we were supposed to dock, when we were told at noon to immediately go to our cabins since there had been an outbreak of the COVID virus on the ship.
And did you hear about the COVID virus before this?
Well, of course, we heard it that on a sister ship of the Grand Princess, we were on the Grand Princess, was sailing around in Japan, and they'd had some outbreaks there. And I think somebody had even died by the time we heard about that. We said, okay, well, we'll stay in our cabin and we'll probably be out later on tonight when this emergency is over and done with. And we ended up staying in our cabin, an inner cabin. Now, I must tell you that before we went, I even tried to get an outer cabin because, you know, we'd heard some rumors about the virus in China and spreading around the world, et cetera. And I was not able to get an outer cabin. So we were in our inner cabin basically for exactly 100 hours from about 1 o'clock on the Thursday until about 5 o'clock the following Monday.
And these cabins aren't all that big either.
No, but a number of very interesting things happened. First of all of the movies that were available immediately. They added more movies to the in-cabin entertainment system than ever before. And on the first day, we were told, as a result of the inconvenience that we had to suffer, we were all going to get $300 back.
Oh.
On day number two, an announcement was made that our entire trip would be refunded.
Really?
On day number three, we were told not only would our entire trip be refunded, but we would be able to book a trip on the ship within the next year, free for the same kind of accommodation that we had there. So although this is all very interesting news, it sort of got us thinking, you know, are they trying to not buy us off, but trying to make us feel positive about the whole experience?
Mm-hmm.
Then we heard later on that about 65 of the people that were on our ship had been taken a previous cruise immediately before this particular cruise on the ship that had problems in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's the Star Princess. I could be mistaken in the name. But you know, I'll say one thing, David. We were treated very well by the cabin crews. They brought us food, you know, three times a day, anything we wanted to have them do. And these people went out of their way to be good to us. Obviously, I think what the cruise line was trying to do was to make it as positive an experience for the people as possible, as humanly possible. And they didn't want any bad publicity. Now, this is, you know, that's only my assumption, but I think that that's fairly accurate.
And at this particular point in the pandemic, no one knew too much about the coronavirus. There was a lot of mystery about it and a lot of questions as to how it spread and how to treat it and all that kind of stuff.
That's correct. I must tell you, on the Thursday before they actually made the announcement for us to return to our cabins, we were told that we weren't going to dock at a port in Mexico. We were going to go straight back to San Francisco. And people were wondering, well, why is it? You know, because some people wanted to see the particular place in Mexico. I've forgotten exactly the name of the town. But, you know, nobody really thought about it too much. And then, of course, as time went on, we heard more and more about this virus. And we were able to watch some of the news channels from the States mm-hmm. and on television. And, you know, I think everybody got a little bit more concerned.
Now, we get to San Francisco, and from what I heard, they wouldn't let you dock right away.
Well, we heard on television that President Trump did not want the ship to return to San Francisco. That would have been on the Saturday or Sunday. Eventually, I guess he relented, and we somehow ended up docking in Oakland, California, which is across the bay from San Francisco. Once we were there, the Canadians that were on board the ship, and there were about 230 of us, as it turned out, were the first people to get off the ship. And out on the dock, right outside of the where the ship was docked, there were three tents that were manned by Canadian healthcare officials. So that when we came off the ship, we went through the tents, and we were all given temperature checks and what have you, and then immediately placed on a bus without any contact with anybody else and transported to an airport in Oakland, where a transport plane was there to take us to Trenton. And now what was interesting is the transport plane had been reconverted into a passenger plane by having bolted to the floors of the plane some temporary seating.
Oh, really?
It was a plane that was totally open from top to bottom, except for the seating, and with no windows at all. So after a couple of hours on the Monday night, we took off and we ended up in Trenton.
Didn't take very long for you to hang around Oakland from when you got off the ship to when you got on the plane to when the plane took off?
We were immediately transported by buses from the Oakland dock to where the plane was landed. We never went through any kind of security procedures at all as far as passport security is concerned. They just wanted us out of that country as quickly as possible. And so 230 of us ended up in Trenton on the Tuesday morning. Which would have been, I guess, the Tuesday morning, March the 3rd. And we were taken to a great big hangar there where immigration officials were set up, Red Cross people were set up, and we were basically assigned our accommodation, et cetera. And then other buses took us to an area on Base Trenton, which is kind of like a motel area. You've got three buildings that are kind of like a super eight motel complex, mm-hmm. you know. The rooms were very sufficient. I mean, you know, you had a television in the room. You had even a small refrigerator in the room, et cetera. And we were assigned to the various rooms there. And that was all extremely well handled. The Canadian officials, both there and in San Francisco, dealt with the passengers in an extremely friendly manner and a cooperative manner. I've got no complaints about that at all.
Now, had you been tested at all up to this point?
Our temperature was tested.
Just the temperature. Okay.
Yeah, just the temperature in the tents that were set up on the dock before we were allowed to go on to the buses to take us to the airport. And once we were in Trenton, our temperature was tested again, and then we were assigned various rooms. The motel complex in Trenton, my guess is that it is basically used by a lot of visiting soldiers and airmen that come to Base Trenton mm-hmm. for various courses, et cetera, because of course it is one of our largest air bases in Canada. And so after we were there for a few days, we again were able to, they brought food to our room, the rooms every day. And on the Sunday, my wife tested positive. They took tests every day, temperature tests every day to see whether or not, you know, you were in any way affected by the virus. And my wife tested positive. And at that point of time, the people that tested positive, as well as their spouses, were moved into an other building that are on the grounds there, one of the three building motel kind of complexes again. She was placed in one room in one wing where basically all the positive people were the people that had tested positive. And the other side of the floor, the people, the spouses of the people that were not positively tested were there. And then after about another 4 or 5 days, I had a slight temperature one night, and I never really thought that much about it. But the next day, they decided to test me anyway because my temperature was somewhat elevated, and I tested positive as well. So I was one of the last people to test positive in Trenton, and we've probably been there at that time for about 10 days. And so we had to isolate for another 14 days. We were one of the last people to leave there, quite frankly.
What kind of treatment would you have been given at that particular point? What were they using? Or were they just letting you ride out the symptoms?
Yes, letting us ride out the symptoms. They took our temperature every day. They asked various questions, et cetera. After I tested positive as well, I was moved to the same wing as my wife. We were supposed to stay there for 14 days. 1 or 2 hours a day, they would let us go out and walk around the complex, but the complex was totally secured at all roadway entrance ways by security officers to make sure that nobody left the premises. And as a matter of fact, I was allowed to leave 3 days early because I was one of the last to leave. That was about 10 or 13 or 11 days into the fact that I tested positive as well, but I had to sign a document that once I got home, I had to stay home for an extra 3 days under the pain of a $35,000 fine if I left my house during that time. So I was basically, when we came home that Saturday, I stayed home until the following Wednesday to make sure that I adhere to the document that I'd signed on for. But the irony is both my wife and I, although we had some what you would regard as minor flu-like symptoms, we would have been, I'm sure, classified as those people that were almost asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. I had flus a lot worse than I ever had during the virus, I'll be honest with you. If I hadn't known any better, I just would have thought, okay, well, you know, you've got a bit of a cough, you've got a bit of this, but you don't really have the virus at all. And I think the same thing applies to my wife as well. So we were some of the lucky ones, but also just to follow my train of thoughts in that respect, it also shows you that people that are very mildly affected, I guess, can transmit it to other people without really knowing that they're doing so. Right. And I think that's what makes the virus so difficult to deal with. We could be meeting many people on a day-to-day basis if we were just allowed to carry on normally, all of us in today's society, that we could be infecting, or they could be infecting us, without really knowing it at the time when the infection takes place, if you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's a message that continues to be difficult to transmit, if you will.
But I just add one other thing. Yes, I think one of the reasons why it got so much publicity, David, was that we were really sort of a week ahead of the curve. By the following weekend, which would have been the weekend of March the 14th or 15th, when everything shut down, the fact that we had it and the fact that we were infected 10 days earlier probably wouldn't have, it wouldn't have created the kind of buzz within the media of the Kingston area as it did. And I still walk around town on a daily basis and people ask me, well, how are you doing? And I said, I'm fine. I was never really ill with it. But I've also realized that my wife and I are extremely fortunate, particularly at our age, that everything turned out as well as they did.
Mm-hmm. So are we. Let's play a song. You asked me to pick a song, and I'm going to let you tell us a little bit about why you chose this particular tune and what it is.
Well, Elvis Presley has always been a great, I've been a great fan of Elvis Presley ever since he came on the scene back in the early 1950s to mid-1950s. And as I mentioned in my email to you, unfortunately, the various people that worked for me on driving back and forth to Toronto during the time that I was there, probably on at least 200 occasions, they were always subjected listening to Sirius Radio Channel 19, which is Elvis Radio.
24/7.
He's a hero of mine. I love his music, especially his spiritual music. Mm. So I visited Graceland a number of times that I mentioned to you. It's kind of a tacky place, but a wonderful place too, as far as I'm concerned. So I've got to play a tune by Elvis.
Then I
Elvis Presley, How Great Thou Art. Choice of our guest today, John Garretson, and he's a big Elvis fan. Did you ever see him perform?
No, I did not. I understand that you did way back when, but no, I never saw him perform. And my wife did see him perform at the old Maple Leaf Garden. Now, this is well before I knew her, back in the late 1950s when he was there. And she still has a ticket stub to prove it.
Really? I never think to keep ticket stubs. Because we saw him as when I worked at CKWS years and years ago, there were four buses of people that went down to Binghamton, New York, 4 months before he passed away to see him perform. And, you know, you hear stories about how big and heavy he was, and he still got the crowd going. And he had that magic that continued right till the end. Let's move on to another topic that I thought would make sense for us to talk about. And that deals with the fact that we want to talk politics, and you certainly have the expertise in this particular field, having spent 16 years on city council in town and 19 years in Toronto as part of the Ontario legislature, also a member of cabinet for a number of years. So 35 years of time in politics, and I think what we need to do is spend a little time talking about how our political leaders approach something like this, a pandemic. Now, you were there when SARS came on the scene, were you not?
Yes, so I was.
That's a little bit like this, but not as serious as this was. So give me some insight as to politicians sitting down and going through a decision-making process on this issue.
Well, first of all, the thing that I think any competent cabinet does, or any competent premier does, and let me just say that the way the whole situation has been handled here in Ontario and Canada, when you compare it to the many parts of the United States, has been exemplary. You go to the medical health professionals and you get the best possible advice from them, and you base your decisions purely on the medical advice. And you know, I can't underscore that enough. And when you see what's been happening in some parts of the United States, and people might say, well, their system is different, or this, that, or the other thing. The reality is that the politics there, it seems to me, came ahead of the professional medical advice. And so you get the best advice possible. You always, of course, especially when there's human life involved, you keep that uppermost in your mind as to how you can deal with the issues in as best a way as possible, based on the medical advice that you're given. And I must say that during the whole SARS epidemic, and before that, the Walkerton situation, you may recall, the tainted water situation. Mm-hmm. And when I was on different sides of the house, there was a unanimity amongst the politicians in Toronto that we wanted to be dealt with in the best possible medical way possible. And it didn't matter whether you were conservative, liberal, New Democrat, or what have you. And you know, I'm kind of proud of that, that it wasn't made into a political issue. And these issues shouldn't be made into political issues. You should take the best advice possible and then make the decisions accordingly and leave all the politics out of it. Because after all, you know, we're dealing with human life, and and you have many, many, many discussions about it. And I'll be honest with you, whether I was in the opposition side in the one case or the government side on the other case, the cooperation between the parties to get that best medical advice was very well handled, I thought, in both those cases.
How do you ride that rail, if you will? And I'm thinking of the small business person who's had to close up shop a couple of times, or else cut back severely in terms of how much business he or she can do, and saw that off against the need to protect the health of the population. You're a politician, how do you handle that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we never had that kind of situation, either on SARS or the tainted water situation, where right. basically businesses had to close. So we didn't have to deal with that issue. You want to be fair. And I guess if there's one small criticism that I have is that it seems to me that the small business person has been greatly disadvantaged in our case. It seems to me that the larger stores that, yes, supply medicine, yes, supply groceries and some of the other necessities of life, have been able to operate under strict conditions. I realize that. And the smaller individual, who in some cases may be providing the same kind of services, has been told to shut down. And so I think if there's any unfairness, it's in that aspect. I mean, we all know, I won't get into any retailers' names at all, but we all know the stores that have been allowed to be open under strict conditions. And sometimes you wonder, well, the smaller stores that can control the number of people that are in those stores to some extent a lot better than the larger stores, you know, they've basically been told to shut down completely. And a lot of those businesses, I'm afraid, are going to be ruined or severely damaged by these lengthy closures. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these are very, very tough decisions. And the most important thing is these decisions have to be based on science and on medical evidence and nothing else. I don't envy the politicians that have had to make these kind of decisions over the last 10 months or so, and in the next 6 to 8 months going forward.
One of the issues that has generated a lot of discussion is the whole business of enforcement. So the government sets rules, or the health units set rules and say, okay, you have to wear a mask, you have to socially distance, you have to avoid crowds. And then you have a segment of the population that says, no, I don't. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to wear a mask. I'm not going to socially distance. And the question becomes, if you have a big crowd, how do you enforce that? How does the government give instructions to the various police organizations in the province or in the country to enforce those rules?
Well, first of all, you try to limit the occasions where big crowds can gather. And as you know, I live on the waterfront here, across from the waterfront here on King Street. I think the city made the right decision when it closed off the newly renovated pier right at the water treatment plant. After it turned out that in September, on beautiful days, a number of students that were in town decided to gather there. Mm-hmm. And so the best way to deal with that is not to allow those occasions to happen as much as possible. And they did that by just closing off the area. It's still closed today, 6 months later or 5 months later, et cetera. So that's the first thing you do, in my view, is you set up conditions that will not allow those large gatherings to take place as much as possible. Some of the restrictions that have been placed on gatherings in churches, for example, I totally agree with as well. You close movie theaters and things like that where there will be a gathering of people. But the reality is, David, if a whole bunch of people in Kingston here decided overnight not to adhere to any rules and regulations, you probably don't have enough police officers mm-hmm. in the city of Kingston to deal with that. And the nice thing that I've always found about Canadian society is that basically everybody wants to follow rules that keep us all safe from one another. And yes, there are the occasion that's happened from time to time that you have street parties here in Kingston or whatever, you know, and then you try to deal with it. And you're not going to catch everybody, but you try to deal with it by at least making examples out of a number of cases that will have an effect on the larger crowd not to do that kind of gathering again. But if the reality is, if all of a sudden in Kingston today, everybody decided to break the law in a particular area, there isn't much that our 120 or 150 police officers can do about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, I think, basically realize it's like stopping your car at a stop sign. If we all of a sudden, there aren't enough police officers to enforce that, But we do it because we realize that if I stop, the next guy will stop too. We're less likely to bump into one another. I'm just using that as an example. If the crowd gets too unruly, it can be very difficult for our law enforcement agencies to deal with that. And it seems to me, it always comes back to this, and I know I'm sort of deviating here a little bit. When you look at what's happened in the United States and Canada, I always bring it down to this principle. We in Canada believe in peace, order, and good government. The state motto seems to be more life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. It's a much more individualistic approach than the more communal approach that we seem to have here in Canada. And sometimes people say, well, you know, but that, I'm absolutely convinced of that. Maybe it goes back historically, the way our country was founded and the way the American country was founded. Now, there's a lot of good things about it, mm-hmm. but this is certainly one of those aspects where, you know, everybody can do whatever the heck they want. And if there are enough people doing it, there isn't going to be enough law enforcement to deal with that situation.
I agree. The differences between the two countries. I want to wrap up with a brief little conversation here about something that's happened in the last week or so. And we are recording this conversation in the first week of January. And I'm talking about politicians deciding to take vacations out of country when they are encouraging people to stay home. Your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, my thoughts are that there are, I don't know how many politicians in Canada, provincially, municipally, federally, who are adhering to the rules. We probably have, I don't know, 10,000, 20,000 politicians. So the ones that we hear about are the ones that are disobeying basically their own rules. Mm-hmm. Now they could say, well, I didn't set those rules, somebody else set them. But basically, you know, if we say that, you know, a particular course of action is the best action to take, such as social distancing, not to travel abroad and things like that, you would expect your politicians to adhere to it. These people have been found out. They're going to suffer the consequences, because I can tell you, David, people may never remember the particular position you took on a particular item within the public debate. I remember one time I didn't pick up after my dog over on the waterfront when I came home late one night. Somebody saw it and reported it to it. People still remind me, you know, you were the guy that didn't look after your dog that day and did his business in the park without you looking after it. So people remember the kind of situation that they can relate to. Mm-hmm. Issues may come and go, but the honesty of the individual, and we may all disagree about how we deal with certain problems, et cetera. I totally agree with, you know, I totally think that's totally legitimate. But it's the little tiny things that people remember later on about their politicians. And but you know, the vast majority of politicians that I've met over my career, I mean this quite seriously, and I may not have agreed with them. They may have been in different parties. They may have taken different positions, but they want to do the right thing. And yes, sometimes we all make mistakes. And perhaps in some cases, these people that you're talking about, there may have been a good reason for it. I mean, I heard some of them went there for medical reasons to mm-hmm. see ailing relatives and things like that. But I guess we all have to judge that for ourselves, et cetera. But certainly you want politicians to live up to what they're saying and what they're recommending to other people. That's the bottom line.
Well, John, I read your Wikipedia page and there's no reference to the dog story there. So I think you're good.
But it's something that I will always remember. And I look back, as a matter of fact, I'm not even sure whether it was your radio station then that had one of your morning hosts take me out to the park and pick up a dog mess for an hour or so one morning. And so that was my way of repaying the penalty for not picking
community
up
service. Well, listen, John, as well. And that, you're still alive and kicking and enjoying life. And I thank you very much for taking part in our podcast today.
It's been a pleasure, David. You know, I will always remember, if I can just leave you with one thing, I enjoyed all my, I enjoyed most of my days in politics. And we live in a great community in Kingston. It is truly unique in all of Canada from so many different ways. So let's enjoy it. The days will get better. And one day we'll look back on these days and say, oh my gosh, I'm glad they're over, because we can all go back to the socializing that we are usually accustomed to. Thank you, David.
Well said. Thank you, John. Our thanks once again to John Garrettson, former mayor of the city and MPP for Kingston and the Islands. This conversation was recorded using Zoom in early January of 2021. Comments and suggestions can be directed to our Facebook page called simply The Kingstonian Podcast. Theme music for the program is Stasis Oasis, written and performed by Kingston musician Tim Aylesworth. This podcast is produced through CFRC Radio at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples. The CFRC Podcast Network is brought to you by the generous support of the Queen's University Faculty of Engineering and Applied Sciences. My name is Dave Cunningham. Join us next time for the Kingstonian Podcast. Thank you for listening.